Sorrell v. Norfolk Southern, number 88597.
Please the court. Counsel. The United States Supreme Court held in this case that the FVLA requires that in a comparative fault case, that the jury instructions given to the jury set forth the same causation standard for both the plaintiff's comparative fault, the plaintiff's negligence, and the defendant's fault. The United States Supreme Court held that the combination of instructions in this case, instructions 12 and instructions 13, misstated the law, because they applied very different burdens to the defendant and to the plaintiff. The court then remanded the case to the Missouri Court of Appeals, directing the court to determine whether a new trial is required. That is an issue of state law. That is why the United States Supreme Court did not decide it and remanded it to the Missouri Court of Appeals. The Missouri Court of Appeals, we believe, applied the incorrect standard. We also believe the Court of Appeals applied that standard incorrectly. To talk about the standard that the court applied, the standard that the Court of Appeals applied did not consider the inherent prejudice that results when negligence, comparative fault, the ultimate issues in an FVLA case, are determined by completely different standards, an apples to orange comparison, as it would be. The standard is also incorrect that the Court of Appeals applied, because the Court of Appeals shifted that burden to Norfolk Southern. And according to their analysis, Norfolk Southern held that burden, and that turns to why the Court of Appeals applied that standard incorrectly. The standard that the Court of Appeals cited indicated that a new trial is required if the jury is misdirected, misled, or confused. The Court of Appeals applied that standard incorrectly because the first of those verbs, misdirected, has been established. The United States Supreme Court held that the jury was clearly misdirected because the standards of causation applied were very, very different.
But we have to decide if it was substantial. I mean, they didn't decide it. They did remand it for the court to make a determination. So it's not as a matter of law that they would get it. We have to look at prejudice, don't we?
Correct. They did not decide that a new trial was required, but the clear holding of the court was that...
How serious was the misdirection? Is that something we have to look at? How serious was the misdirection?
It was very serious.
But that's a relevant issue, looking at...
Yes.
What?
And I think the elephant in the room is that these standards were intentionally very different.
Haven't all the parties agreed that it was error to give both instructions?
Yes.
So which instruction do you favor?
The instructions we submitted were the...
2401?
The instructions that we submitted were that both parties be governed by the same standard in whole or in part.
In whole or in part. And is that how we've revised the instruction now is revised so both...
Yes.
So in whole or in part is applied in any other trial now. That's what's used for both parties.
Going forward.
Right.
We also believe the Court of Appeals misapplied the standard for the first reason I stated, that the jury was clearly misdirected on the law. Further, the way that the Court of Appeals...
What's our standard review on prejudice?
On prejudice?
Yes.
I believe that in a case like this, and we talked about this a little bit in the brief, there is no Missouri case that defines what is the standard of review for instructional error after the United States Supreme Court has found an error?
Hopefully we don't have it often enough that we have to develop.
Because prejudice
is
presumed by the failure to follow MAI.
That's correct. And
so we hardly have any cases about whether it's prejudicial or not, because we already know.
And that same standard should apply here. It's presumed prejudicial.
And that's really, and both parties have, and we have cases on if MAI is the correct law and you fail to follow it, whose burden it is. If there is no MAI, whose burden it is. If the judge acts on his own, whose burden it is. Here we have a different situation. They followed MAI, but MAI was wrong. Whose burden should it be as a matter of policy? Is that kind of what it comes down to?
As a matter of policy, it should be the same as in the situation where there is a deviation from MAI. The reason that rule exists is because MAI is presumed correct.
So it should be the proponent to show that it was harmless?
It should be the person who benefited from the error must have the burden to show.
Let me ask you this. In the final arguments in this case, did either side rely upon these particular instructions? Did the plaintiff argue that this is what our burden is and this is what I have to prove to you? And then conversely, did the defense argue anything about the instructions on this to the jury? In other words, was the jury argument based upon this instruction?
Was the jury argument based upon this instruction?
This variation?
On the variation, no. While decisions of this court have recognized that the court can consider argument, I certainly think, I don't know of any decisions, and I certainly disagree with the proposition that instructions that clearly misstate the law are not prejudicial error because one party didn't argue it. Obviously, I didn't argue it.
Where it goes to the essential issue in the case, you know, the
correct
and false.
Correct. The most essential issue. But what the parties did argue, and to my second point about how the Court of Appeals misapplied the incorrect standard, I think the
Why wouldn't it be like if there's no applicable MAI? Because there was no valid applicable MAI. Why wouldn't we treat it kind of like those cases where it's not an MAI instruction in effect? There's no valid MAI instruction. So since that was an incorrect statement of the law, so should we treat it like other situations where there's no valid MAI instruction and we look at whether or not there was prejudice but the instruction was bad? How do we look at prejudice in that situation?
I don't think so, because the point is MAI is a deviation from MAI is presumed prejudicial because in that case the parties, the trial court, have deviated from a correct statement of law.
Right.
In this case, it has been the United States Supreme Court
held. So why isn't it like there's no MAI?
Why isn't it? Because in those situations, and I think the cases that have examined this type of issue in those situations, where there is no directly applicable MAI, have still found prejudicial error.
May be here, but why isn't that how we? And for our guests, the MAI is Missouri Approved Instructions. When you have jurors there and they have to understand the law in the case, we instruct them about the law. And there was an error in the instructions the judge gave the jury this time. And we're trying to figure out if that means you need a new trial or not.
The reason why is because, again, if there is a deviation from a law that is presumed correct, in this case, the United States Supreme Court has held what the correct law is.
Mm-hmm.
That should be presumed error. The only factually similar case was not from this court. It was the Dickerson versus St. Louis Southwestern Railway case. That on remand to the Eastern District, the Eastern District applied the standard that we're supporting here. The Eastern District held that based upon the trial court's award, the respondent, the plaintiff, could not show a lack of prejudice. Again, that is the only case that has arisen in this same posture. But to pick up on Judge Wolf's point about what was argued at the trial court, the second way that the Court of Appeals misapplied the standard is that I think they adopted the plaintiff's view that this was just a case of one driver versus another, one man's word versus another, and the jury absolutely had to believe one man or the other. The case was not nearly so simple as that. What the instructions make clear is that The plaintiff submitted two alternative theories of negligence, that either the driver wouldn't was negligent or that the railroad failed to provide a reasonably safe place to work. And if you look at the beginning of plaintiff's counsel's closing argument, when he started talking about this accident, the first two pages of argument were about how the employer failed to act, failed to provide a reasonably safe place to work. The first line was, the reason we're here, I'm paraphrasing somewhat, the reason we're here is because the railroad didn't have a plan that day. The railroad failed to evaluate the working conditions. The railroad had these two men in trucks working on a road that was too narrow. So the plaintiff submitted different theories of negligence as against the railroad. The railroad submitted two different theories of negligence as against the plaintiff. That Mr. Sorrell, who admitted that he, in his version, both vehicles started a good ways back. He drove for 5 seconds or 10 seconds or 15 seconds and basically saw this coming, got over to the edge. So we submitted different theories of negligence, that Mr. Sorrell failed to stop when he saw this coming, and that he failed to keep his vehicle on the roadway, because obviously what's unquestioned is there was a track that led into the ditch, and there was no contact. So how did the jury sort those out? How did they weigh the two different theories of negligence as against the railroad, as against the plaintiff, and how did they sort out the driver's different versions? Mr. Sorrell said immediately after the accident, and there was evidence of his accident report where he said both drivers got off the road. Mr. Wooden said, Sorrell said right after the accident, Sorrell told the supervisor, and the supervisor also testified to this effect, that Sorrell said both drivers got off the road. At trial, Mr. Sorrell said, I got over the edge, he never got over. How did the jury sort that out? And then how did the jury sort out Mr. Wooden's different version of events? Because he told different versions of the events, too. In a post-accident report, he said both drivers got off the road. At trial, he said, I wasn't close to him. He drove off the edge. I was back a few hundred feet. So how did the jury sort all those issues out? Which of either man's version did they believe? And did they believe that Wooden was negligent, that the railroad was negligent for failing to provide a reasonably safe place to work? There's any number of different permutations and combinations there. I think what is absolutely clear from that, absolutely clear, is was Norfolk Southern prejudiced by a different jury instruction? Might the jury have found and decided the issues differently if the standard said in part instead of directly caused? They may have thought that Mr. Sorrell was negligent in a minor way, 5% of fault, 15% of fault, and therefore he wasn't directly negligent. They might have thought that the railroad was negligent on both theories, but that they might have thought he was negligent on both theories, but that he reacted negligently and therefore was not direct.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. The one thing that I have found interesting on this appellate process during the last 4 years following Mr. Dick through the Eastern District to Washington, D.C., back to the Eastern District to here in Jefferson City, which I'm honored to be, is their argument changes every time they present it. And they are playing games with this. And I'll tell you another thing, when they go back to retry this case, if you order it, they're going to change their position again. They say it in their brief. What the Norfolk Southern wants to do with Mr. Sorrell and his wife for the last 8 years is use this case as their vehicle to change the landscape of FVLA law throughout the country, all the way back to Rogers. And how they got that hook started was when Mr. Dick objected at trial of the approved MAI instruction that the trial court is mandated, as we all know, to give. Judge Berger had no choice. But what they raised there was the word directly contributed to cause, because that was part of the Missouri common law on negligence. And we are still, our negligence instruction on common law cases is directly caused. That's how we in Missouri define proximate cause in common law of negligence. The Supreme Court Committee in 1978 amended the FVLA verdict director 24.01, which was given in this case, unobjected to, in fact, endorsed by the Norfolk Southern and Mr. Dick, as the reason why the Missouri contributory negligent instruction is wrong by having the word directly in it, which he then argued successfully created this different causation standard. This notion now that the jury did not weigh the partial fault of Tim Sorrell, this is the first time I heard it in his reply brief after eight different briefs we've gone through to get here. And when they go back to trial, what are they going to say? No, the Missouri verdict director is wrong. It should be proximate cause in the verdict director. And, oh, by the way, you know, the Missouri contrib instruction that we successfully got changed in the U.S. Supreme Court, by the way, it was right. That is the game that's being played here with the Sorrells. And let me tell you what I think you should look at is the U.S. Supreme Court. They simply said causation standards have to be the same. And in the primary opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, and it came from a question in oral argument by Justice Stevens to Mr. Carter from Sidley and Austin, isn't it, sir, simply your objection to the word directly in this instruction is the problem? Yes, it is, because that is what changes the causation standard. And what Chief Justice Roberts deferred to Missouri, his primary opinion is, it will be up to the Missouri court to determine whether or not Sorrell's fault was a direct cause of this injury. That's what we're here to talk about. That's what their opening brief was. They talked about slight cause and approximate cause 16 times, never argued this in whole or in part thing until the reply brief, when we pointed out there, under the instructions they give, failed to stop his truck or failed to keep it on the roadway. That's the only two submissions they made.
So if we remand for this to be retried, what instruction do you favor?
I favor the MAI verdict director, but he's going to disagree with that.
We've already revised our verdict director since the...
No, I'm talking about the plaintiff's verdict director against the employer.
But we have revised our...
Right, and may I respectfully discuss that with you? Because I don't think your instruction...
That's not an issue in the case here at this time.
Well, it will be on retrial if we go back, because we're going to be back again.
You can use your time however you like.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Please ask your question.
No, that's fine.
How did the Court of Appeals get it right or wrong? I mean, if you want to support the Court of Appeals decision.
Right. How did they
get
it right?
Get it right or wrong? Don't tell us about the other side's argument.
Okay.
Just tell us that.
They got it right because they concluded that there was no set of facts that could conclude that Sorrell did not directly drive his truck. This wasn't an issue of competing causes. There was no dispute about that. He either stopped his truck or he didn't stop his truck, and the jury weighed that. And how did they weigh that? They did it in proportion of fault of the two people in the damage instruction 8.02, which was not objected to, which is the MAI instruction. And I want to point out about the new Missouri contributory fault instructions that has been modified. If you look at Chief Justice Roberts, he says the language in whole is not in the statute, Section 53 of the Act, and it has no place in that statute because it would... respectfully, make no sense. Because if the employee negligence in whole caused his injury, there would be no liability of the railroad in the first place. Justice Ginsburg pointed that out in her dissent, where she said, certainly, that is an imperfect instruction, with all due respect, and that certainly...
Maybe that's why initially they had the contrib instruction not say that, because it wouldn't have made sense.
It wouldn't have made sense. All the really...
made sense. Well,
what should have been done, candidly, and consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court opinion, in 1978, Mr. Dick had it right at the trial court, when this committee, Supreme Court committee, changed our verdict director in 1978 for employer's negligence and took out the word directly, we should have taken out the word directly in the contributory fault instruction. We didn't do that. That was the mistake. That's what the instructions should now say. This whole or in part has no notion. First of all, the Supreme Court does not endorse that. In fact, the dicta here is they wouldn't endorse it. But why? Is because it's not in the federal statute. The contributory fault statute does not have the language in whole or in part. So now we're left with a contrib instruction that's not consistent with the federal statute. And our verdict director, using the language in whole or in part, is a direct quote and parrot from Section 51. And so... the bottom line is, there it was two truck drivers, and the jury knew what they were comparing. We argued that in court, and they knew that they were comparing the fault of two truck drivers. They did it in the damage instruction, and the notion that the word directly affected that calculus under these facts, as Justice Ginsburg said, certainly could not have been prejudicial to the railroad. And I only point out that this is a moving target because it shows really the fact that they don't truly believe there's any indirect causes here. The Eastern District challenged them to articulate one. They did it in their brief. It was nonsensical. I challenged every one of them. And in the reply brief, we forgot about the direct, indirect, and we went shifted over to the in whole or in part language, which was never part of this discussion until the reply brief and the argument today. And the standard review, the Eastern District, and I think makes sense, and there's a lot of cases from this court that say, first of all, you got to be practical. This court has issued a mandate to the trial bench and the trial bar, use MAI. Trial judge had to do it. Unfortunately, we had a word wrong. But now, when we know that that word had no impact on this verdict, we want to go back and retry a case that's 8 years old. And I believe that the Norfolk Southern on review has to articulate one fact that shows that there was an indirect cause here. There are no such arguments to be made. There cannot be. They know that. You can't indirectly drive your truck or fail to stop your truck. You do it with your own hands. That's what the Justice Ginsburg said, and that's what the Eastern District said, and that's what we were supposed to review. There is no notion in this record that the jury didn't compare the faults of these people. The only notion they raised, the only issue that was brought up, is whether the word direct changed the causation standard. And unless there's any other questions or clarifications, I'll be happy to answer questions. I'm passionate about this.
I would just say that, you know, the court would invite you to write a letter to the MAI committee or to the court for the MAI committee if you have suggestions on the instructions, because that's the format in which we look at instructions. But you're saying that this difference you think made it non-prejudicial.
Right.
And that highlights that.
Correct.
That's
and I'll be happy to submit that. I don't want to be critical of the court. I'm only pointing out what the
We revise court. And change them all the time and always appreciate comments.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your time.
I'd like to first respond to the claim that we didn't raise. I'm not sure what the claim is that we didn't raise until the reply brief, but I think we've made it clear throughout that we believe we are prejudiced by these very different causation standards. We made that claim at the trial court. We made that claim in the Missouri Court of Appeals in 2005, the United States Supreme Court, the Eastern District earlier this year, and we've made it in our opening brief. Our opening brief.
Can you tie the claim to the evidence in the case? Claim to the evidence in the case. Just say how you believe you've been prejudiced by the change of wording relative to the evidence in the case.
Yes, to the evidence in the case. The point that I was making earlier, the jury had to decide whether the railroad's negligence was a cause in whole or in part. Had to decide, they were instructed to decide, whether the plaintiff's negligence directly contributed to cause the accident.
Was there any evidence that the jury would not have considered if it followed the instruction only to consider the evidence that the plaintiff's own negligence directly caused? In other words, did that exclude some evidence from their consideration?
Did, if I understand the question, did the trial court exclude any
use of directly?
Would the jurors reading that instruction, listening to that instruction, have disregarded evidence that you believe should have been regarded, should have been accounted or taken into account by them?
You're saying
yes.
They're misdirected by using the word directly. So how? Were they told not to consider something?
They were not told not to consider
something.
Does
the use of the word directly in effect mean they didn't consider evidence that they would have had that word not been used?
Probably. There is no way to know
isn't that the prejudice issue?
That is the prejudice issue. And the jury was told to weigh and compare the fault of the two parties. They weighed them by different scales, by different standards. That's inherently prejudicial. They were judging it by completely different
measures. But opposing counsel saying if there was no evidence, they would have considered the, if all evidence went to directly, then the fact that they shouldn't use the word directly doesn't make any difference. If
directly, problem is you can never prove actual prejudice because you're not in the jury room to know what their deliberations are.
Correct.
And so you have to go through presumptions.
I mean, the jury may have decided that Mr. Sorrell reacted negligently. The railroad started the negligence by not evaluating the work site. Mr. Sorrell was negligent when he drove off the road.
And then
they may have decided that was not direct. He was reacting.
Okay. That's the kind of thing I was asking
about. That would be a cause in part, but not necessarily a direct cause. They may have decided that Mr. Sorrell had a minor percentage of fault and determined that was not direct. But that would have been in part.
Unless there are other questions, thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
And the court's adjourned.